You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Brookings on this beautiful first day of fall. Not so beautiful for the Redskins, but beautiful for me because I get to host my good friend, Lieutenant General Eric Wesley, who, as you know, is the Deputy Commanding General of Army Futures Command and also has roles within future concept development. And he's based in Fort Eustis, the Army Futures Command, of course, in Texas. But you guys are building a whole new enterprise around the country. Just a quick word of additional introduction for General Wesley, and then we're just going to have a conversation for about the first half and then involve you for the second half, if that's all right. He is part of, you know, a couple of years ago, people talked about the Marine Corps takeover of Washington with John Kelly and Jim Mattis and Joe Dunford. Now we're talking about the Class of 86 West Point takeover with Secretary Esper, Secretary Pompeo, and General Wesley.
Some of us are just slackers, you know, others move on.
And so he finished his studies there at that time. He's had other studies and degrees, but he's also deployed quite frequently in operations or in combat, including to the Balkans in the 1990s, to Iraq for Operation Iraqi Freedom, and also to Afghanistan most recently on a couple of separate tours there. He's an Army officer by training, which means that he's been thinking about technology and the future of these big 70-ton behemoths that we call tanks and other such things that naturally come up in thinking about the Army and its future. So if you wouldn't mind joining me in welcoming General Wesley, please, to Brookings. And I thought the easiest way, General, to start this conversation, since we're here to talk about multi-domain operations and the Army modernization strategy, which are specific phrases, slogans, bureaucratic efforts that are in the larger context of how should the Army respond to new opportunities and new risks. I wonder if you could just sort of trace through, you know, the evolution of how this came to be, this concept, and then we'll get into the details of what it actually is. But what problem is it trying to solve? What are its roots in sort of the recent 10-year past?
Yeah, I'm glad you opened with that, Michael. You know, the idea of solving problems is what really drives the best innovation. You hear a lot of people talking about you need to be more innovative, but absent a problem to solve, rarely do you find the right innovation that you're looking for. So what problem are we trying to solve in the Army? You know, you've heard recently a lot of talk about great power competition. The National Defense Strategy talks about the return of great power competition. And for most of us in this room, in our adult life, we've enjoyed a period where problems posed by near peers or adversaries have not adversely affected the United States, our partners and allies' ability to influence the world on behalf of our national security interests. But we find that's changing. And so what has changed? I think that you've got China that has experienced an unprecedented era of economic growth, the likes of which we've never experienced. On the Russia side, they've really this idea of revanchism, to return to the era that they knew, where they had esteem and wanting to reestablish the near abroad. And then they've watched us over the 1991 and 2003, and they recognized that they had a problem. So there's three areas our adversaries have invested that have posed a problem for us. The first is we are challenged in all domains. When I say all domains, I mean space, the electromagnetic spectrum and cyber, maritime, air, ground. And those domains are challenged. That's different for us because we've enjoyed about 30 years where we could do almost anything we wanted uninhibited. And how you fight will change if those domains are challenged. If you have universal communications all the time, you're going to behave differently than if you don't have communications for extended periods. If you control the airspace at free will, you're going to behave differently than if you are vulnerable from the sky. All that is changing now. That's a tactical problem that we deal with. The second area where we find that our adversaries have invested is they've invested in multiple layers of standoff. I said they watched us in 91 and 2003, and I think what our adversaries have concluded is they want no part of close combat with the United States, our partners, and our allies. So what do? You invest in ways to keep the United States and their partners and allies away from their interests, which is no surprise that China has invested in islands in the South China Sea. It's no surprise that Russia has invested in integrated air defense and what we call anti-access aerial denial. And then the third area that we've got a problem is this idea of our adversaries having the ability to leverage the competition space to achieve their objectives left of conflict. You hear about gray zone activities, active measures, any number of ways you can describe it. But we're challenged by this notion because of our cultural roots. We don't find it attractive when the national security apparatus is spending time aggressively left of conflict because we don't believe we're a warfighting people in our DNA. So we struggle competing left of conflict, but that's where I think our adversaries have seen our Achilles heel and where they're achieving their objectives. So those are the three problems that we seek to solve.
That's a great conceptual framing. And now, General, if I could, I want to get stay on the same subject and line of inquiry, but get a little bit more concrete and specific, because as you and I were just speaking, we know that these kinds of attempts at big new innovation that combine different operational concepts with new technologies, with new strategic realities, they have a long history. And we were talking about air-land battle back from the 70s and 80s. Then the Army started to struggle with its Army After Next concept in the 90s and the cancellation ultimately of some of the systems associated with that, like the Future Combat System. Then we also heard the Joint Force talking about Joint Vision 2020, Joint Vision 2030. And then since 2012, we went to President Obama's Defense Strategic Guidance, H.R. McMaster's Army Operating Concept, in a similar kind of role to what you're doing now. And then still in the Obama administration, the third offset that Secretary Work, General Selva, and others are associated with, which seems to have continued in some ways, but now there are some new names associated with that, which is natural in a political world. But I wondered how you would explain what MDO is in the context of all those previous efforts, especially the ones that came since 2014, when we were already worried now about great power competition. But you've clearly seen the need to do something further, something bigger, something more bold and innovative. So I'd just love to hear more concretely and specifically, what is MDO relative to, let's say, the third offset?
Okay. Well, first, is at the expense of maybe sounding a little bit wonky, I'd like to talk a little bit about what a concept is. You know, we all know what concept is, small c, but in the Army and the services, we talk about concepts, and it's important to distinguish the difference between that and doctrine. Doctrine describes how we operate with what the capabilities we have now and the talent we have now. Concepts describe what we must become based on the problems that we anticipate. So it's an azimuth that we want. It's a target that we see ourselves moving towards in the future. It's a forcing function that drives the institution to change. That's probably the most important. It's a forcing function to drive the institution to change. And by the way, it's not just a forcing function for material development. It's holistic change across the force. So Michael described air-land battle. That was published in 1981. There was a concept that preceded air-land battle, interestingly. It was called active defense. And these are theories that help you solve the problem, but oftentimes concepts don't last because they are either proven ineffective or inefficient or not achievable. Initially, a good concept is infeasible now, but it drives you to invest in something. So when active defense was published in the 1970s, General Starry became the 5th Corps commander in Europe and found that it didn't solve the problem of the numbers that we would expect from the Soviets to come across the border in the Fulda Gap. So he came back to become the TRADOC commander here in the States, and he said, active defense doesn't work. We need an approach to fight outnumbered and win. And the byline of fight outnumbered and win and defeat the second echelon simultaneous to the first was that really the crux of what air-land battle was, and it drove us to change everything. It drove us to invest in the big five material development. It drove us to invest in new training centers. It gave us more space. It changed our professional military education. So it was a holistic modernization that ensued from the description of a concept.
Thank you. I don't want to interrupt. You're about to go on?
I would just say not all concepts come to fruition. So Force 21 in the 90s really wasn't a fundamental change. It described digitization. The 2014 document probably didn't go far enough because really what we were coming to grips with a new era. My only point to finish would be we think multi-domain operations is akin to the relevance of Airland Battle 1981. So it is the most fundamental rewrite on how we will fight in the future and will drive our modernization into the years ahead.
By the way, there are three seats up here if anybody wants to sit down, be our
guest.
We'll
call on you first.
Yeah, exactly. I wondered if you could, to the extent it's possible, for a concept, which, like you said, by definition is a little earlier and a little more conceptual, a little more intellectual, if you will, if you could still nonetheless point towards specific kinds of weapons or other technologies or concepts for specific tactics or operations that you see being boosted, facilitated by this effort. So, for example, we hear a lot of talk about hypersonic weapons these days. Maybe that's one of the, and I think Secretary Esper, when he was here at Brookings as Secretary of the Army, talked about that as a big concept. There are other such concepts as well, or other such technology-specific, tangible, you know, real things. Is there anything you would counsel us to take note of? Because I also see that the budgets still have modernization for the M1 tank, and still have lots of the big five, you know, helicopter programs in them. So how much has the Army already changed? Maybe it's unfair to ask if you're more of an R&D and conceptual place than a hardware developer, but what do you see at least on the horizon as exciting new technologies that then could be married up with new doctrines and really help us in future conflicts?
So let's go back to the problem. Remember, I said one of the big problems is this multiple layers of standoff. Imagine if anybody's a boxing fan, you're fighting Evander Holyfield, who is renowned for his reach. And if you're going to fight Evander Holyfield, you need to do two things. You need to have a good stance, you need good posture, and you need to be able to penetrate that reach in order to make your strike. It's no surprise that the number one material modernization requirement or program that we are pursuing relative to the problem I just described is long-range precision fires. So hypersonics is an example, the milligun as we affectionately call it, but the ability to reach out and touch at extended ranges. Well, if you're going to reach out and touch at extended ranges with long-range precision fires, that imposes another challenge for you. You need to be able to have the sensors to identify targets. So the idea of incorporating low-Earth orbit satellites, et cetera, in order to help us target with long-range precision fires. Those are two examples that I might describe. There's others.
That's great. The Army has these six different bins of technology that it talks about in the MDO context, although I'm never quite sure how much they overlap. You just explained a couple of specifics. We also talk about the future of vertical lift, equipping the soldier, missile defense, cyber defense in the network. So I think I'm near the end of the big six with what you've already discussed. Thank you. Are there some areas where you're finding it's frustratingly slow going, where not so much you necessarily, but the broader state of R&D in the United States on advanced technologies is going to make it hard for, let's say, two or three or four of these six multi-dimensional, or cross-functional teams and concepts, make it hard for a couple of them to progress the way you would like?
Yeah, I'll mention two as examples. One that fits into the category of technology that we've never experienced but know the merits of, and another category of trying to break out of our past, trying to move forward. So the first category, we think that artificial intelligence will be imperative in order, not when we're thinking about robotics necessarily, but to augment human decision making. So when you've got a very hyperactive environment with a myriad of countless targets and the need to incorporate all the weapon systems of the joint force, the Air Force, the Navy, and you're trying to integrate all five domains, all of which are controlled by a different echelon or by a different service, the need to be able to respond rapidly with the right weapon system at the right time will only best be achieved by the use of a significant combat cloud or data lake that then you can apply artificial intelligence to prioritize targeting. So getting after, there's a lot of talk on machine learning, But the ability to take weapon systems and integrate them on the battlefield using artificial intelligence is the next, I think, big problem. And we completely agree with the Air Force that the next joint program that will be most important for multi-domain command and control is artificial intelligence. The one that, you know, when we want to extract ourselves from the past, as, you know, if anybody read the exploits of Napoleon, for example, one of his biggest challenges were lines of communication. That remains a challenge to this day. And we you mentioned the M1 Abrams, which consumes fuel at a rate that not many weapon systems compare to. So how is it that we extricate ourselves from the industrial age notion of continual flows of fuel that was germane to the automotive revolution, and the idea of maybe leveraging hybrid electric power so we can cut the ties of our long, significant logistics chains, which make us vulnerable to targeting. So those are two areas that I think we've got to push on: artificial intelligence, hybrid electric power, or alternative power source.
Great. And the next question, as we sort of work through this, which I forewarned you about, but because I told you it's going to be a little bit of a skeptical question of multi-domain operations. When I look back on some of the different slogans or frameworks or concepts that have been developed over the years, we talked about air, land, battle. That was pretty good. Army after next, maybe not so good. Net-centric warfare that the late Admiral Sabrowski talked about, among others, that was probably good, but I'm not really clear what it made happen that wouldn't have happened anyway. It sort of was a reflection of where we were in history at that moment,
right,
more than it was a big new impetus for development. I could go through these different slogans and different initiatives over the years, but the point remains that, you know, and one more, I guess, we talked about air-sea battle, less with the Army, more with the Air Force and Navy. Then they decided it was either politically incorrect or too much Air Force-Navy or something, so then they turned it into the joint concept for access and maneuver in the global commons. I think I got that right. And if you don't remember, then that's sort of the point, which is that they sort of killed the idea by burying it in a long phrase when it was no longer. But it was clearly some of the things in air sea battle are still alive and well, as well as some of the things in the Army operating concept in various previous incarnations of this sort of conversation. So my point is, my question is, how do you make sure that multi-domain operations really gets us someplace meaningful and is targeted enough to take advantage of specific opportunities, address very specific problems, and not try to be all things to all people?
Yeah, thanks, Michael. Two points I'd make. The first is that the fact is that concepts are always changing. And it's actually a good thing because it reflects thinking. You're never going to predict the future with perfect clarity. We do the best we can. I wouldn't say any of these concepts are ever failures. We perceive them as such because they go away, and we presume that they weren't useful because they went away. The reason they go away is because oftentimes we learned from the concept that went before us, and then we illuminate it more on a subsequent concept. So that's why you see concepts come and go. Now, some have significant traction, like we described with air, land, battle. What makes this different? How do we know that this is not all things to all people? The first is, I think we've been very clear on some very tangible problems that must be solved, that absent solving them, we will see the influence of the United States, our partners and allies, wane in the ensuing years if we don't. So there is a serious problem that if we want to continue to be leaders on behalf of our ethics and way of life, we need to solve these problems. So and they are not germane to the name. They're germane to the environment. And one of the benefits of MDO right now, it is aligned to the National Defense Strategy, which I think describes the world as it is. Some other concepts, we would develop ideas on behalf of capabilities that were unclear as to their utility. We know that what we describe in multi-domain operation, does anybody think there will be fewer domains in play on the battlefield in 2030? Does anybody believe that the extended range of weapons will get smaller in the ensuing years? So there's some pretty foundational aspects of the way we derived this that I think make these problems reside until they're solved.
So getting near the end of my question, so please start loosening up and getting ready for your own. But I wanted to ask you to specifically preview for us, to the extent you can, the Army Modernization Strategy, which I think is forthcoming, and we built it up a little for this event. I know you wanted to talk about it, even if it's not yet, you know, something you can completely unveil. But I think from what you've taught us about the difference between concepts, doctrines, strategies, I can begin to guess what your answer will be to this. But how is the Army Modernization Strategy going to relate to Futures Command and your work there and multi-domain operations specifically?
It really gets down to modernization 101. How do you change an institution as large as the United States Army or even the Department of Defense? And so we did describe that that the concept is a forcing function to change an institution. But absent a modernization strategy, which applies, you know, which defines the ends you're trying to achieve, the means and the resources you're going to go after, absent a strategy that describes a pathway, a roadmap with decisions along the way and trades across the FYDP or the POM, absent that, then we're just hoping we get there. So any good institution that expects to modernize has to have an accompanying strategy with any concept that we arrive at. Otherwise, it's just a thought piece. The Army Modernization Strategy that senior leaders are finishing up and will soon release will be a document that will be the governing tool that the new Army Futures Command, that General Murray commands, uses to hold the enterprise accountable for their tasks over the course of the next several years. Because again, if you're not holding the institution accountable across the varied tasks that we will have to modernize the Army, then you're just hoping you're going to get there.
So more night court in the future for the Army.
There will be more night courts, I'm sure.
even as we all salute and thank General Dunford and await General Milley as his successor next week. And I know a big day of transition at DOD. But since General Milley had something to do with some of what you're talking about, it may provide continuity, or we'll have to see, I guess, right? General Milley will be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff as opposed to the Army Chief of Staff. Sometimes people's perspectives change. But I have to assume that you are overall feeling here is one of gratification with the former Army Secretary, now the Secretary of Defense. This probably will show up. Some of the ideas you're talking about will probably show up in next year's budget proposal.
One would hope.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll go to the audience now, please. I guess we'll start with one at a time and just wait for a microphone, if you could, and identify yourself. We'll come all the way to the front or the second row, Sydney, to start, and then we'll work around the room.
Sydney's like Ellen at the White House, always gets the first question.
Yeah, I decided to call on him before I actually saw who it was, yeah. But because he was so enthusiastic, I just saw the hand. But delighted to have your questions, yeah, as always.
Sydney Friedberg, inevitable and slightly stalkerish, yeah. Deputy editor from Breaking Defense. The whole issue of the gray zone, this competition space, I still struggle. I'm probably not alone, to figure out what specifically the Army does there and what, you know, the Joint Force does there and what, you know, the vast and amorphous interagency does there. I mean, are we talking about things? It seems like it's everything from, you know, debunking fake news, deep fake videos on social media, to, you know, special forces advising people in a country that's under assault by proxies. I mean, is that indeed the spectrum of things? Where is the line drawn between the competition phase and actually now we're in conflict? Where is the line drawn between the Army's piece, the competition phase, and a civilian-led piece?
By the way, if you want, before you answer, we have no rule here at Brookings against promoting our own book. So if you want to mention the Senkaku paradox, my book, which tries to speak
you
to
won't
this,
mention
but
it.
I wouldn't mention it. Yeah. That'd be a little rude.
So, Cindy, that is indeed the spectrum we're talking about, and then some, right? As an analogy, those of you who remember the 1992 election when President Clinton was elected, we talked about the war room. And the war room was an opportunity to watch the daily news cycle every single day and then to appropriately counter it. If you use that as an analogy of what's happening in the competition space and then some, it's not a bad analogy. We tend to saddle ourselves with a post-Westphalian behavior in our national security efforts. And that is, number one, we allow, for understandable reasons, the country teams of each of our embassies to lead on messaging throughout any given country. But Europe has got a lot of countries associated with it, and the region tends to behave with continuity as opposed to along boundaries called borders. So to have the ability for the interagency to include the military, to have a coherent strategy and or counter approach to the unconventional warfare and information warfare that we see every day might be something that we want to think about with greater detail. But there's another aspect to this. If our effort to expand the competition space, which is always intended to force, not only counter their message, but to force our adversaries to recalculate their position, if that fails, you're going to find yourself potentially in a conflict. And if you want to defeat a fait accompli attack, there's certain targeting that you have to be doing every single day that no operational headquarters is doing on the scale we'll have to do it against adversaries. So I think to your question on whose role is it, interagency or the military, I think it's the interagency, including the military. The military brings with it capacity in a theater that maybe the country teams don't have. And so you put those things together and the collaborative, cooperative nature of what we're trying to achieve and what we would talk to at the interagency level brings more capability and our ability to counter what they're doing in that gray zone.
But state has no COCOMs.
No, but they do have regional ambassadors, right? And that could be something that we are able to increasingly collaborate on. But to your point, they aren't in theater, that's for sure. And so, but who is? And the military brings capacity to the table. And it doesn't mean the military has to be in the lead, but we certainly can collaborate in a way that would aid and enable the efforts of the other agencies.
Does that mean we need either new structures or we need to bring in people from Treasury and USTR and other places into the combatant command planning cells, or is there any kind of structural change in the government that could facilitate this?
Yeah, we haven't proposed structural change to the government. It wouldn't be our role, but we have described what it takes to win. And if you aren't actively engaged in that space, the information space, the targeting space, the cyber space, you know, on a daily basis, and there's a coherent command and control mechanism to do that, that organizes those messages, I think you struggle and you put yourself at a disadvantage.
Great. We'll stay here in the front with Sandy, and then maybe we'll take two at a time this round, if you don't mind.
Thank you, General Sandy Apgar, Senior Advisor at CSIS and former Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations. You've understandably, and the Army as a whole, describe modernization often, usually, in technological terms, in one form or other. Question is the degree to which you're thinking of the change in relationships between the private sector and the military in managing the non-warfighting infrastructure services facilities in a more business-like way.
In a number of ways, the answer is absolutely yes. We had the opportunity to brief Speaker Gingrich on our concept, and one of the things, very thoughtful in the interaction, but he said, you know, this is not just an Army concept, it's not just a joint concept, it's not just a whole of government concept, it's a whole of nation concept. And to your specific point, I think in order to compete left of conflict, which includes the messaging space, the cyber realm, it will be imperative that we, and you talked about trade, it will be imperative that we have companies, privately held companies, be actively engaged. And frankly, I don't think it's helpful when companies like Google self-select out of collaborating with the government in trying to solve some of these very difficult problems. That's on the active left of conflict efforts. I think you're going to have collaboration and cooperation. But even on the technical side, our ability to take a little more risk in order to cooperate and collaborate on what our requirements are, I think will be absolutely imperative. And I think you're seeing that the structure of Army Futures Command, the reason the Chief of Staff of the Army and the Secretary of the Army stood up Army Futures Command was to have a single point of entry to coordinate some of these efforts. The reason we have CFTs is to create the opportunities and venues to very specifically share with our industry partners what our problems we're trying to solve are.
Great. We'll stay up here in the front row for a
Thank you, General. My name is Dong Yun Kim from Voice America Korean Service. Now, you addressed about the great power competition, but in the NDS, they also mentioned about North Korean threat equivalent to that.
They also mentioned what?
North Korean threat equivalent to the great power. And I was wondering how the future, the future command is addressing with such as underground terrain, as you mentioned about the multi-domain problem. North Korea has a lot of underground terrains that would be the big fight on the end, and also the recent development of Iskander-type missile, as well as you also mentioned about the AI utilization. Now, North Korea is a very secluded nation, and the United States relied most on the HUMINT by South Korea, and HUMINT is a human domain. It's very subjective. How are you going to address this problem while you're utilizing the AI?
Yeah. So a couple of things. One of the things Michael Hanlon said earlier is with the concept and modernizing an army, you can't be all things to all people. So we use this thing called a pacing threat. And we really did a lot of the analytics on Russia, but it applies to China. We're not designing the army necessarily against some of the other threats, although we have to be cognizant of them, right? So you mentioned subterranean. You wouldn't, you know, based on the design of the future army, subterranean requirements are not there. But what when you modernize an army, what you do is you make sure that your investment efforts build the army that gets you to defeat your pacing threat. When you diverge from that, which we have in many cases for the Korean problem, to include significant investments in the sub-T problem, you just have to do that eyes wide open. So the army is accommodated for the Korea problem as an exception to the azimuth that we're building against an adversary. To your point, you're right. Artificial intelligence is not going to be as helpful for you in that conflict. But that's not the biggest challenge that we might have. And that's a challenge that we deal with every day. And I think we have leadership that is accommodating it.
Another question. The woman here in the sixth row back. Seventh row.
Hi. Thank you, Kathy Gladstone. Question. You're talking at a very high level. What are you doing about the people on the lower level, soldiers, sailors, recruiting, training, educating, the military?
So thank you for your question. You know, Michael counseled me when I came in, make sure you don't talk on a high level, so I haven't hit that mark. There's a number of things I could say here. First of all, I mentioned that when you have a concept, it is a holistic modernization. We will have to fundamentally change again our means by which we educate and how we train, because the weapon systems that we will employ will be different. The design of the weapon systems have to be intuitive, because the change at which technology comes, we need to be able to integrate it into the force very quickly. A third area is on a hyperactive battlefield, we will find that what we call mission command, but what you would just understand as probably as initiative, independent initiative, will be on a scale that our generation has never seen. So we are changing the training at the tactical level to encourage the thinking that allows subordinates at very low levels to exploit initiative that they see as opportunities. That takes very specific training requirements in order to accommodate that. I could think of others, but I agree with you 100%. All this stuff has to be understood and be usable at the tactical level. But I'll give you one final example, and I hope I'm scratching the itch somewhere in here. I said artificial intelligence being able to integrate targets at the operational level. What does that have to do with the scout that's on the reverse slope of a terrain feature? Right now, in the Army I grew up with, that scout would understand what's on the other side of the terrain feature based on his own organic reconnaissance capabilities. If you can have tactical formations be able to access a combat cloud with an uplink that is aided by artificial intelligence applications, you can imagine that an F-35 that just flew over 10 minutes ago, which sucks in all kinds of data, downloads into a cloud, that that scout, that soldier, can access information from an F-35, low Earth orbit satellite, etc. So now it becomes very real. What our job is to translate that right down to the very tactical level so you enhance the individual soldier's capabilities.
Excellent. Thank you. Stay here in the fourth row.
Good morning. Sharon Foster, Army National Guard. What are the impacts you see of modernization to the Guard and Reserves? What are some unique touch points that we should be focused on?
Yeah, that's a very good question. A couple points I'd mention. The first is, I said that posture is important. There's three tenets of multi-domain operations. The first is calibrated force posture. And all calibrated force posture is, it's four things, really. It's forward presence, permanent or otherwise. And if you imagine rotational, that will be have implications for the Guard having to rotate forward in order to ensure we have the right resources forward. Second, it's expeditionary capacity. The degree to which you don't posture forward, you're going to have to get it to the fight very quickly. Third is this ability to access national assets, which I've already given some examples on. And then fourth is authorities to use those assets in the competition space and in the tactical space. Now, I want to share this with you, though. As we talk about forward posture, the National Defense Strategy talks about contact forces forward and blunt forces that come in very quickly. When we lay out the force package in Europe and the force package in Indo-PACOM, what we identify is there's a number of units that are right now resident in the Guard that we need in the contact layer. So one of the things that the Chief of Staff, I'm sure, will have to deal with in the ensuing years is to what degree will we have to cross-level, take some force out of the active force, put it in the Guard, take some out of the Guard and put it into the active force. That's something that will take years to analyze, but it has implications for the Guard. For example, bridging assets. Significant amount of bridging assets are in the Guard that if you are going to conduct a campaign in, say, Europe, you would need those assets much more quickly than we would have now. So I think that that will be something that comes forward, but you can expect that the Guard will have to be available to be part of rotational forces, as they have for years now. And or second, we will have to collectively plan about potential cross-leveling over time.
I want to add one more question of clarification while we're on this topic, and also with the question about the men and women of the military. If we're thinking about If we're thinking about how you can be effective in hitting a target that's several hundred miles away, how do you figure out the right technology and where to base it? Because we have big problems with that right now and trying to figure out, can we put them in Korea? Can we put missiles in Japan? It occurs to me that if you're using Russia as your pacing function, you may be sort of letting yourself off the hook from that question, because in Europe we have a lot of close-by allies. And the corollary to this is, what are the roles for the other military services, the Air Force and Navy and Marine Corps, as you develop MDO? We had an event here 2 years ago with an Air Force general who was working on MDO. And I assume that's sort of your closest sister service on this particular initiative at this moment. But if you could speak to that, please.
Yeah, couple points I'll make on that. First is you pointed out that we have a significant number of partners and allies, part of NATO, et cetera, in the European continent. And maybe you're begging the question, well, what about Indo-PACOM theater? Well, you know, concepts have implications not just for material modernization, like I said, at training, but it also has implications for policy. It might orient and help orient our senior leaders on how would we want to better integrate in the Indo-PACOM theater. It might have implications for the Indo-PACOM commander. And so it gives us an azimuth, an orientation on where is the right place to put weapon systems of that capability just to secure waterways, for example.
Great, thank you. So the woman in the gold shirt in the fifth row, please.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm Caitlin Dorman. I work for Improbable, a technology company. My question is, in AI augmenting decision making, How much does that come into the planning versus operational phases, and how will the Army put AI through its paces before being used in an operational way?
Well, let me start with the way we have done business the last 30 years. You know, we have prided ourselves on the joint force and within the Army that we do very well at synchronizing a battlefield up front. Usually, if you look at an operations plan, you know, on a campaign, it might be an inch, 2 inches thick, you know, with very specific synchronization requirements. Synchronization is absolutely imperative. But if one of the challenges we could argue we've had in the last 30 years is we haven't exercised that approach with a peer adversary, where the opponent gets a vote. And this, and the very finely tuned, synchronized plan starts to break apart. Then what? And what we're saying with artificial intelligence is the ability to augment the right adjustments to our decision making based on the influence or impact of an adversary. So to your question, where do we see artificial intelligence fitting in? I can imagine that artificial intelligence will give us the ability to do dynamic airspace control, where you're changing airspace management in near real time. That's in the operational fight. I can imagine a targeting sequence, a pristine targeting sequence that you have originally planned for being changed while an aircraft is in flight. So to your question, I think it's near real time, it's in the operational fight, and we need to be able to exercise it therein. Now, how do you do that? And you know, how do you test that? Well, I think, frankly, that there are AI companies already testing that in airspace management in the civilian air sector, for example, where you can start to see how that would be helpful as we go forward. But it would definitely be something that we would want to exercise a lot, yes.
Gentleman in the green shirt, and then I'll go here, and then I'll work towards the back.
Hi, my name is Sangbin. I'm working for the Radio Free Asia for Korean Service. I have a question about the long-range precision fire. I remember you mentioned before the North Korean missile can be the reason why the U.S. Army developed a long-range precision fire. So can you tell me how relevant long-range precision fire to deal with a North Korean missile?
I don't think it's germane to North Korea. As I said earlier, we looked at our pacing threat, and we're looking at both China and Russia on this problem. And you know, Iskander was mentioned earlier. These are capabilities that have only gotten better. And so we're not investing in long-range precision fires because of North Korea. We're investing in long-range precision fires because it's the problem that we have to solve as we go forward and we project into the future. So that's why I laid out the problem right up front, but I wouldn't say it's unique to the North Korea problem.
Over here, please.
Hi, my name is Melissa Harris. I'm a tech reporter with Meritalk. You said that developing AI was one of the sort of pain points for Army Futures Command. So I was wondering what strategies you guys were taking to tackle those challenges and get to where you want to be with those AI capabilities.
Thank you for that question. We put Army Futures Command down in Austin, Texas. I think there's a lot of discussion on that. Why did the Army do that? One of the reasons we went down to Austin is, although we have a long history and a long legacy of leveraging our own labs to develop technology that have been just exceedingly effective over time. If you look at the investment of the United States government, it's inverted over the last 40 years. In the 1960s, two-thirds of R&D dollars came out of the U.S. government. Now it's inverted and only one-third, whereas two-thirds is coming out of the private sector, universities, et cetera. So why would we abridge our ability to be exposed to that kind of science? So we knew we had to get away from just our labs. And so we leverage our labs. They do great work. But we also want to be in the space where young kids with laptops at Starbucks are developing ideas. So we embedded ourselves down there in Austin as a startup community and an ecosystem that has these incubators and progressive thinking. We have this organization called Army Applications Lab, and it's in an incubator down there in Austin called Capital Factory, so that we can be bumping into, smashing into young people with innovative ideas. Now, to your question specifically, one of the branches of Army Applications Lab is the AI Task Force at Carnegie Mellon University, one of the premier universities where we talk about artificial intelligence, so that as we explore this on our own, we can be rubbing shoulders with those that think about this every day. So we stood up an Artificial Intelligence Task Force, and we put it at Carnegie Mellon, and those are the two key things I think I'd want you to take away on that.
Excellent. Go to my friend in the baseball cap.
Hi, I'm Elliot Hurwitz, and I want to thank, I worked for the World Bank for 20 years, and I worked in the Intelligence Committee. I want to thank both of you for a very good presentation. In the New York Times on September 10th, there was an article by the General Counsel of NSA, Glenn Gerstle, who said in his article, technology is about to upend our national security infrastructure. He further said, It is on an unprecedented scale and pace of technological change will outpace our ability to effectively adapt to it. And he ended by speaking about quantum computing and encryption. He was giving a lot of credit to foreign adversaries. I'd like to hear both of your comments on that, please.
So I'm not a physicist, and I want to caveat that right up front, and I'm not as much even a technologist. I'm a warfighter, and I'm a soldier. But we're cognizant, sir, of those things, and I think that is imperative. One of the things we talk about in the concept is that as a nation, this is why I said earlier that collaboration with industry will be imperative. The ability to harden, and that's probably not even a good term, because you're really going to not be able to hermetically seal the vulnerabilities of the United States. Rather, you would probably better to say constant vigilance to protect the homeland, and even that's a generic term. But we expect that we will be targeted immediately as we move out of our motor pools in the continental United States, that power grids and rail systems all will be vulnerable. So there's a story a few years ago, a guy named Mike Vitelli in Washington State. He was a subcontractor. He had a company with 15 people. You might have read about this story. And he was an excavator, nothing sophisticated. And he found that his website had been hacked. And the FBI paid a visit to him. And he said, why would anybody want to hack me? It was not only were you hacked, but you were likely hacked by the Russians. And old Mike Vitelli is in there outside of Eugene, Oregon, saying, why is my 15-man company being hacked by the Russians? What they found was that he was the soft underbelly to a power company up in the Pacific Northwest, and that upwards of 70% of the power companies throughout the continental U.S. had been exposed in a similar way by virtue of that effort. Now, that's Mike Vitelli with a 15-man company. So when I say vigilance and harden, that's a whole-of-nation effort that we'll have to get after. And I think that's what the gentleman was talking about, and a clarion call that this is not something that is an Army problem. This is a national effort that we all will have to be involved in. I hope that answered the question, sir.
That's great. I'm going to keep going to the back for a little bit. Let's see. We've got, I think, these two right here. One in front of the other, maybe take them together and then come back to John Wesley.
Hi, Matt Bainart, Defense Daily. I just have a quick two-parter on the updated modernization strategy. When do you expect that to be released? We've heard around mid-October. Do you expect that to be the case? And then on MDO, last fall, the 1.5 concept was detailed. So how far along is the Army towards MDO 2.0, and what kind of specifics are you working through in order to get to that point?
You want to take that right now, or go take ahead. One more? Go ahead. John.
Thank you. Jake Sweeley from the Elliott School of International Affairs. My question, sir, is does the scope of Futures Command include doctrinal aspects and structural changes to the Army as an organization, or is it mostly focused on technology, expecting those aspects of reform to come after?
Thank you. I'll start at the first question and come to yours. On the aspect of when will the Army modernization strategy be released? I think Chief of Staff has been gone public and said that October is a good timeline, no later than the end of the year. So he's bracketed it, and you know all the senior leaders are reviewing and now making some minor adjustments to it as we go forward. As we when we go to MDO 1.5, let me just a little bit of background. As Michael Hanlon mentioned earlier, we published MDB, Multi-Domain Battle with the Air Force, about 2 years ago. We called that 1.0, and we always said to the Air Force that late in 2019 we would publish a 2.0. But in the interim, what the Army decided was, you know what, we don't want to wait to do that. We need, inside the Army, because we were so aggressively pursuing modernization, we needed that azimuth out there. So we published what is now called the Army and Multi-Domain Operations 2028, and again, nicknamed it 1.5. We don't want to presuppose what the other services will do. What we're saying in our document is this is what we think the Army has to do, leaving open-ended the plugs for the other services. 2.0 is not a new version of MDO. What we're describing 2.0 as the initiative with the services to create a joint concept. And this is really important. It won't be, I don't think, distinct, but it's the collaboration with the other services, because multi-domain operations, by virtue of, you know, the intuitive understanding you're taking all domains, it has to be a joint concept. So it's the next level that we have to get to in order to have a common view across the services. And right now we're in the midst of that with the other services. I think that we'll have, I think General Milley has said this, the Secretary of Defense has said that we need a joint concept. So you'll see that as priority work, I think, in the next year or so. As far as the next question, doctrinal, remember what I said up front. Any modernization has to be comprehensive. It's not just material. In fact, you get greater gains in changing how you fight than any kind of technology that you bring to the battlefield. So what General Murray has been charged with doing is modernizing the Army across the entire future force modernization enterprise, which includes doctrine, organization, material, training, leader development, policy, facilities, all those things. He has been given the charge to hold all those enterprises accountable for modernization. Now, TRADOC might do a lot of the writing on the doctrine, but in terms of choreographing the pathway and describing what is needed, General Murray and Army Futures Command leads that choreography.
Over here to the gentleman next to the window, please.
Thank you. Thank you for this panel. This is really great. Chris Nywame, I'm a contributor for Newsmax on the Hill, former Army enlisted. General, in your mind, when it comes to acquisitions, how do you balance sort of the need to be on schedule on the one hand with the need for competition for a highly visible franchise program like the optionally manned fighting vehicle? So kind of staying on schedule versus the need for real competition in terms of the acquisition context.
Yeah, I think that's, first of all, I think we're growing in this space, both those on the Hill who have given us increased authorities and those in the services who are learning how to leverage those authorities, right? But first of all, I would say, you know, we're all accountable to a board of directors, and cost, schedule, and performance is imperative so that we honor the resources that the American people give to us. So that is a very important side of the tension that you described. What we think we need to do is to make sure we are leveraging all of the authorities that the Congress has given us before we go ask for more. So as we stood up Army Futures Command, one of the goals were to leverage those first, make sure our house is in order before we go back to the Hill. I would argue that we're still learning on how to be agile and using those exceptional authorities. And I can also imagine in the future, as we get good at that, the services may come back and say, hey, we need to be more agile, because our adversaries don't have some of the constraints that we do. As I said, important constraints, but we need to make sure those don't hinder our ability to enhance our national security apparatus on behalf of the people that fund us.
Thank you. The woman here in the sixth row, please.
Thank you, General, for coming today. I greatly appreciate it. Lauren Mitchell, I'm an intelligence officer in the reserves and also coming from Recorded Future, a threat intelligence platform, and also servicing open source intelligence. My question, you know, we've been really focusing on offensive strategy in the physical space, but I'd like to hear how you assess, you know, the modernization strategy as far as defensive in the, you know, cyber realm where adversaries have actually been able to hit us at home, whether it be involving our election infrastructure and being able to, you know, hit us there or just in the larger cyberspace as well. Thank you.
Yeah, so I'm admittedly not an expert in the cyber realm, but I will say this. You mentioned that we've talked a lot about the offensive nature. I want to be clear on something. The United States and our lens and our culture, we're in a strategic defense. We like the status quo because we want the ability to continue to thrive within the cultural and ethical norms that we hold dear, right? But what I described that seems offensive is the very aggressive nature with which you have to be in a defense. And the degree to which we demonstrate that we are very capable to defeat a fait accompli attack forces our adversary to recalculate any intentions they may have had such that you change their behavior, which by definition is a defensive action, right? In the cyberspace, you know, this is interesting. We culturally, because it grew up in the intel community, I think that there's a great docudrama called Zero Day, and it talks about the fact that we don't talk a lot about what we do in cyber because of the origins and the DNA that it comes from. That's something I think we're all coming to grips with, and to the degree to which you communicate your intentions, not unlike what we did in the nuclear era. But I'm going to defer to Cyber Command and them to talk in the details on what's in the realm of possible. But it is one of the domains that will be fundamental. And it has to be incorporated at the operational level. And I believe that the authorities to leverage it will be necessary to move down to the tactical and operational level.
We have time for one more. Actually, let's take, go to my friend here in the second row, and then the gentleman all the way back. I think that'll have to be it. That's okay.
Sure, excellent presentation. George Nicholson with the Global Special Operations Forces Foundation. A little over a year ago, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Neller, over the Atlantic Council, stood up and he said the biggest threat the Marines face in the future is our dependence upon GPS and SATCOM. And he gave an example of being in Afghanistan, asking one of his Marines to show him on a map. And they said, we don't use maps anymore. Well, they've gone down the path of pulling the plug. A week later, I was over at the Simpson Center, and Admiral Richardson said they've got the same problem in the Navy. But along those same lines, one of individual who worked here at Brookings is now over at New America is Pete Singer. And his book, Ghost Fleet, the Commandant of the Marine Corps said that is absolute required reading for every one of my Marine officers. And matter of fact, he's got Pete working with Marine Futures. Your comments?
And take the last one together, if you don't mind.
Hey, sir. Hello. My name is Paul Tennant. I'm the Army Attaché for the UK. It's good to see you again, General. I'd just like to ask you about transitions. And I think we in uniform, I hesitate to speak for the US Army, but certainly in the British Army, we tend to think about phases somewhat in silos. The term phase zero was difficult in this respect. And as we think about left of the bang and right of the bang, I think we're also in danger of doing the same. What I'd like to ask you, therefore, is when those transitions are probably going to start happening faster and faster and affecting a lower and lower tactical level at speed, and probably working in both directions, how are you managing your balance of investment decisions on smoothing the bumps of those transitions?
Okay, thank you. I'm going to take that one first, and then I'll come back to yours. So I don't know that we can smooth the bumps of the transitions. I think we have to condition ourselves to get used to the bumps. So just a different way of looking at the problem. Because we culturally have a very clean distinction in our mind between competition and conflict, or peace and war. It comes from our Judeo-Christian roots, and we believe there's this very high threshold for war. I said that we're not a war-fighting people. And so, but that distinction is so branded in our mind. It starts with the Constitution, our laws, our policies, our behaviors, that to mobilize takes this significant threshold that we have to cross. Whereas what we're describing is adversaries that are operating in the competition space all the time. And if we don't get into that space that's very gray and ambiguous with authorities to compete, what you will see is we will lose market share over time. So I'm saying not to smooth the bumps, but to get used to the bumps is going to be, I think, the challenge that we face. You know, just yesterday, we were talking about what happened in Saudi Arabia and the attacks on those oil fields. We are days away from that incident, and there are still debates as to who the originator was. So the problem we face is that with an adversary is in play, you have to ask yourself, will there be a situation where you have a fait accompli outcome and you don't even know who initiated it? That's problematic as long as we keep very clear distinctions between what is peace and war, competition and conflict. To the question, sir, you asked, I don't know that it's our biggest problem, but here's the thing. I don't think it can be either or. It's got to be both and. My son just graduated from basic training at Fort Leonard Wood. Thank you very much. I'm very happy about that. And I asked him, I said, did you learn how to use a compass? And he was very excited and proud that he was able to read a map and use a compass. But that doesn't mean at the same time that we abandon the great virtues of PosNav or GPS or, you know, all these things. So I believe it's a both and we don't have the luxury to avoid either of them.
Thank you, General. Please join me in thanking General Wesley.